Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Patrick, what are you writing over there?
Oh, I'm just making some notes on things I want to mention on these next two episodes, Jim.
Good idea. Do you keep all the notes in a certain place?
Yes, here in my little red book.
All right, Patrick, one of the real issues with the pandemic, of course, we don't get to see our friends in person. And so,
right,
you know, we get to have them on the Zoom, and that's nice. But, you know, it'd really be great to see somebody like, you know, Nick Scalera once in a while, you know, like over at the house or that sort of thing, right? But,
right.
What are you going to do,
cool
right?
What cool t-shirt is he wearing today? He's always wearing a cool t-shirt. I'll never forget the first time I met this guy, Jim. We did an outdoor event at a brewery in Leesburg. Remember this?
Yep.
And there was a guy wearing an MC5 t-shirt. I was like, wow, dude, that's a great t-shirt. Sure enough, that was the
prized possession.
There you go. Yeah. So we'll do the Zoom thing until the crisis passes. So it's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And welcome to the show today, Nick Scalera.
Hello, everyone. Great to be here.
As you mentioned, Patrick, Nick has been a longtime listener and a supporter of the show, and he's a patron, and we have him on, and he can pick a topic. And he always picks great topics. And of course, before he even was a patron, he was picking topics because he was doing the Flying Nun Week stuff.
That's right.
Which still to this day is really popular. In fact, we have in our newsletter this week as we're recording this, our listener of the week is a guy who mentions he started listening to our show because of the Flying Nun Week episode.
Oh, so there you go.
So that's how popular those have been. So how do people get the newsletter, Patrick?
Just go to suburbspod.com, give us your email address, and it comes every Friday, you know, generally between like noon and 9 p.m.
Somewhere in there.
Nah, it's usually before the hootenanny, though. So let's just say noon to 7 p.m. Eastern time every Friday.
But every Friday. Free. We're consistent on the day, at least. Go to suburbspod.com.
Yeah, we get it out there.
And
got some fun stuff in there.
Newsletter. There you go. Okay, let's get to the matter at hand here. So, Nick, you get to pick the topic for today's episode, and it's not Flying Nun. We'll save that for another time. We'll revisit that. What do you have for us today?
So today I'm going to talk about Arthur Lee and the band Love, and a little specifically about the album Forever Changes, which a lot of folks may have some name recognition for. It's one of those albums that's in a lot of top 100, top 200 lists. It's considered a masterpiece by a lot of critics. It wasn't very popular in the time. And it's one of my favorite albums of all time. I mean, literally, if I had to grab three in a disaster, I'd be taking Forever Changes with me.
It'd be one of the three. This doesn't surprise me, though, because I just from the time I've known you, it's come up many times. You know, so
it's a touchstone.
And it's great. It's a great record. It's a good one to have, you know, in your top three, I think.
Right. And so I have been wanting to talk about it for a long time. So I figured this would be a good opportunity to do so. Also, I thought what I'd try to do is provide a little context because, you know, that album kind of sits out there as like the one great thing this band did. I would argue that's not true. But, you know, it's sort of divorced of that. There's a lot of interesting strands of the life of Arthur Lee, his background, his musicianship, the other guys in the band, and sort of how they got to that point, and then also how they never really achieved those heights again, and sort of the backstory to that. So that's what I thought we would chat about today. And by chat, I mean talk about at length.
That sounds good.
It sounds great, Nick. And I want to say a couple of things. One, you know, we have a lot of fun with Nick playing on his Flying Nun obsession, but he does like other music. He likes both kinds, country and Western. And I want to say the way you set that up, Nick, so true. I mean, when I was coming up kind of in the music scene in my own evolution of like discovering and going back and picking out stuff and like building a record collection around Cornerstone albums, you know, that was one of the coolest finds, right? It's like Love, Forever Changes, this amazing band from LA. And wow, look who was in it. You know, it was like Maria McKee's uncle or something.
Right.
And all that. And for a long time, that was all they were known for. And they definitely were not like a band that just had this one weird album. They had a career that we're going to talk about that definitely had a very big impact. And I think like many great pieces of art, not appreciated in their time, you know, right away, but has grown in stature and influence. And that's the case with many great artists.
Absolutely. You know, I think it's one of those things that different generations will kind of discover. And we'll talk about this towards the end. But what makes it great, I would posit, is its timelessness. It does not feel of its time. And I think if you can pull that off with a piece of art, that's where you have that sort of longevity, right?
All set.
So cool. So should we dive in?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Awesome. So just as a quick intro, the band Love is an LA band. They started up around 1965. Arthur Lee is the main guy. He's the leader. He's the songwriter. And one of the things that was notable about Love is that they were probably the first, you know, racially integrated band that was in existence and sort of coming out of that LA scene. And what's interesting, we'll talk about this, is that it's a really eclectic mix of sounds that you hear in Love. You hear anything from folk rock to hard rock. You hear blues. There's flamenco stuff. There's mariachi. There's jazz. There's orchestral things. And you'll see in this three-album run, which is really what we're going to talk about, is sort of the two albums before Forever Changes and Forever Changes, you hear this incredibly diverse body of music that was, again, not hugely successful in terms of sales, but very influential. In fact, you know, Forever Changes is in the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry. So that's a pretty high seal of approval there. There's many other laurels that have been heaped upon it over the years, but it's been interesting for me. I've been a fan, as you know, for a long time of this album, but I spent some time digging into sort of how the song was made here, where these guys came from, and it's a lot more interesting than I could have imagined. And I think what is truly just amazing about Arthur Lee is just his background. And, you know, he was born in Memphis, Tennessee, and, you know, they're very much associated with LA, but he grew up in Memphis. He was born March 7th, 1945, which, ironically enough, March 7th is also my birthday, and I didn't realize that till like a couple weeks ago, and I almost passed out.
Wow.
So that's cool. And March 7th actually is going to come up in another song reference. So stay tuned for that.
Astrological sign does that make both of you?
That's a Pisces.
Pisces.
So he was born to Agnes Porter, who was a school teacher, and Chester Taylor, who was a jazz musician and cornet player. So right from the beginning, you sort of have some musical ability in the family. But, you know, Arthur's sort of racial background, it was complex. And he even says himself, I have a quote from him where he talked about growing up, he was an only child. And he says, I felt like a loner right from the start. My mother was fair of complexion and looked white. My father was a brown-skinned black man. As I grew up, I was too light-skinned to be black and too dark-skinned to be white. And this is sort of one of the very interesting things about Love and Arthur Lee's background and sort of the racial composition of the band is that Arthur just sort of moved in different worlds. He moved from psychedelia to R&B to, you know, white hard rock, back to soul and funk music later. And he was kind of a chameleon that way. And that sort of comes out in what you hear in the music later on.
Yeah, and I'll say really quick, Nick, that it's so interesting to me, too, about the whole composition of the band and, like you were saying, the different styles of music. Because I think, what are we talking about, right? It was the mid-60s and people were gathering in Los Angeles, but it called not just white suburban people to sort of tune in and drop out and go to San Francisco, you know? It attracted all races and all cultures and everybody, you know, kind of got in touch with that message. And it's really reflected in Love. In some ways, they're like one of the most reflective of the times between Clark and Hilldale of LA.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, he was born in Memphis and, you know, in the segregated South, you know, in the early 50s. So when Arthur is around 7 or 8, his parents divorced and his mom just sort of up and moved to California, which is, you know, very common story. You hear about the Great Migration where African-Americans moved from the South to California and up North. But, you know, when they arrived in 1953, his mother remarried a man called Clinton Lee. So that's where Arthur got Lee. Actually, he was adopted by his stepfather, who was actually a pretty successful building contractor. So, you know, Lee was fairly well off for a young African-American man living in LA in the 50s and was an only child and actually had access to musical instruments and things that he needed. It wasn't sort of a poverty situation. But, you know, the other thing that's just amazing about this story, and this is one of these things that reminds me a lot of like when John met Paul on the bus or whatever the hell that story is. When they were in Memphis, Arthur Lee's family was friends with a family called the Eccles. And Johnny Eccles was a childhood friend. The families knew each other and Arthur and Johnny were friends in Memphis. And they lost touch when Arthur and his mom moved out to California, South Central LA. And, you know, a few years later, he's walking down the street and there's Johnny Eccles. And it's like, what, you know, to me, that's one of just those crazy musical coincidences that you just can't even believe, but it is absolutely true. And so Johnny was also interested in music and Johnny Eccles becomes a sort of the main guitarist in this classic lineup of Love, a fantastic guitarist we'll talk about. But that like huge coincidence to me is just so fascinating that they sort of grew up in Memphis. Johnny Eccles is also African-American and they meet in what was a mostly white neighborhood in LA. Several years later, completely unplanned and is a sort of crazy coincidence. But to move the story forward, Lee was always interested in music. His first instrument was an accordion, which I find really fascinating and maybe sort of indicative of he was sort of a, you know, like a musical savant.
Yeah.
He was not classically trained, could not read music, but could play sort of any instrument you would hand him and also could just kind of write music in his mind and hear things and mimic them. That sort of comes up later as they work on Forever Changes, that ability. It's just this sort of uncanny ability to write songs from an early age and kind of hear them in your head and express them.
It's yeah, really rare. And I'll tell you this, like we recently talked about, hey man, if you're not getting laid with a theremin, you're certainly not getting laid playing the accordion.
Right, so that
may be why he switched.
Exactly, exactly. So sort of getting us up to around to where Love started, you know, by 1963, doing my math here, so he's like 18, right? He's just out of high school. Arthur's starting to get into bands. And he's not only that, but he's already writing music for other people. He's already involved with like record publishing in LA. This African-American young man of 18 is going to Capitol Records and pitching songs. He had his own group that was called the LAGs, which it was actually a play on Booker T and the MGs. It was Arthur Lee and the LAGs. And
funny.
It was the same kind of music. It was more of a sort of rhythm and blues kind of, not at all like what would happen later with Love. But notably, he actually produced a single during that era called My Diary for Rosalie Brooks, which isn't the interesting part of the story. The interesting part is that Jimi Hendrix played guitar on that song. Mm. And Jimi Hendrix was known as Jimmy James or something like that at the time. Yep. And later in life, Arthur Lee often intimated that Jimi Hendrix kind of stole his style. And if you've sort of seen the fashions that Arthur Lee had earlier on before Jimmy became Jimmy, there's probably something to that. But Jimmy actually looked up to Arthur. You know, at the time, Jimi Hendrix was playing with Little Richard. He was a backing guy in bands, right?
Yep.
And so this is one of his first opportunities. So another just wild coincidence in the life of Arthur Lee. But to get us to Love. All right, we're there, folks, I'm telling you. So this is 64, 65. Obviously, the Beatles are happening, and notably in LA is the Byrds. And the Byrds were a huge influence on Arthur to the extent that, like, he had this band, you know, this LAG band. They were doing sort of standard rock and roll R&B. And when he heard the Byrds, he's like, that's what I need to do. Like, I need to do folk rock now. And he sort of had this conversion experience. He's like, this is the direction I want to take my music in based on what was probably the first couple of singles from the Byrds. And that's how he got hooked up with this guy named Brian McLean, who is the uncle that Patrick referred to for Maria McKee or whatever that relationship is. Brian McLean was a young white kid with strawberry blonde hair who just had that sort of folk rock look. And he was in the Byrds orbit. In fact, he was a roadie for a long time. And that was what sort of led Lee to hook up with Brian McLean, was this connection with the Byrds. In fact, this probably wouldn't have happened because he was a roadie with the Byrds. And when the Byrds went to England, they left him home. They said, we don't need you to come. And so Brian McLean was like, all right, forget it. So you have Arthur, you have Johnny Eccles, who we talked about before. Yep. You have Brian McLean, and they're the nucleus for this band that is actually called not Love, but the Grassroots.
Yep. That's right.
Does that name ring a bell? It should. So
maybe that's why they changed it. Yeah.
Right. So when they found out that, in fact, there's this whole backstory I won't get into, but Arthur had some conspiracy theories about this manager and this, maybe that the Grassroots was stolen for them. Anyway, there was already a band out there with a hit single called the Grassroots. So that is when they changed the name to Love. There's a lot of mythology around how that name came about. I haven't heard a good explanation yet, but it works. Sometimes the simplest names work, right?
What was the Grassroots hit single?
Everyone knows the Grassroots, but I'm having a hard time remembering.
I'll take the Grassroots for 200. I would miss that. I have no idea.
But so now we've got Johnny Eccles on guitar, got Brian McLean also on guitar. They hooked up with this drummer named Don Conca, and Don Conca was this fabulous drummer who was a Gene Krupa kind of guy and could solo for 10 minutes. And unfortunately, though, Don had a drug problem, and Arthur actually sang about that in the song called Sign DC, which is about the drug habit of Don Conca. But he was replaced by a guy who, no lie, his nickname was Snoopy, Albin Snoopy Fisterer, who was the first, you know, sort of official drummer in Love. They also hooked up with the bassist, Johnny Fleckenstein. He didn't last that long. He's replaced by Ken Forsey, who was in a surf band before then. And now we have the sort of classic Love lineup.
Right.
So nice. We're there.
Okay.
So around 1965, 1966, what they're most known for is just a blistering live set. They would fill up clubs on the Sunset Strip, various different clubs. And there was one club called Beatolito's that was a small place, but they used to literally block off the street because they had a private access road behind, because so many people wanted to see this band that they would put speakers outside and sell $5 tickets to people outside who weren't even in the club to listen to Love. That was how big they were.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, Lee was a very charismatic front man. You know, you have this racially mixed band, the latest hippie fashions, and they played really loud too, by all accounts. They were just sort of a loud band. So they're kicking around in clubs, April 1965. And at one point, this guy named Jack Holtzman, who was the president of Elektra, and Elektra, which we all know now, mainly from the Doors, back in the day, they were a folky label. They were just folk, New York folk coming out of the clubs. And Jack Holzman, like a lot of record executives, was like, well, I want to get me a folk rock band on my label. And he went out to LA. He saw Love play at Beatolito's. And he's like, this is my band. I've found the band that I need to have on my label, my first rock band, and like sign them immediately. So now we got a record label.
Yeah. And I'll say, if you don't mind, Nick, there's a great book written. I think it's Jack Holzman's autobiography. It's a fantastic book. Not only, like you said, Nick, was he a savvy judge of music and talent, he was a very savvy businessman, right? So he built Elektra up into a very hip, very profitable label. It wasn't like a label that took chances, but it signed this cool, eclectic roster. And it was like a really interesting mix. And for Love to get signed to that label was really like a very important step. So it obviously showed they were doing something original. But also, like you said, they had marketable potential. Like Arthur Lee was going to be a front man that was going to attract fans and sell records.
Right. Exactly. And from Love's perspective, being the sort of first rock band on the label, they figured that they were going to get the full resources,
which
didn't actually happen. But that was the theory.
Well, it's right,
time.
Though, because Elektra followed the trends, like, oh, folk music's hot, you know, on college campuses. Let's sell that, you know, and then they kept shifting and shifting and shifting, and he did it really well.
So they go into the studio in late 1965, early 1966. Essentially what they did, 4 days in the studio, they just put their live set down, like blasting all these songs out. And what you hear in this first album, it's self-titled, called Love. It's very garage rock stuff. It's got a kind of a proto-punk kind of edge to it. There's R&B. You know, it doesn't really sound to me like, you know, we talked earlier, Arthur Lee wanted to be a folk rock band. I don't hear much folk rock in this debut at all. I hear stuff that actually sounds closer to punk or pop punk. You know, you've got a fuzz tone bass, you got jangly guitars. It's just kind of a rip roaring set. And it's not an album that a lot of people know about, certainly not as well known as Forever Changes, but I highly recommend it. It's a fantastic album and it really sort of moves. And I thought maybe what we can do now is actually play a song. And this is a song called Can't Explain. Not I Can't Explain, just Can't Explain. And for my money, it's pretty close to the other I Can't Explain in terms of quality. It's a rockin', rip-roarin', broad rock song.
Can't explain, nothing seems to be going right. Can't explain, nothing seems to be going right. When are you wake up in the morning?
One of the things I love on that is that bass sound that Ken Forsey had, this sort of, I don't know, it was sort of a violin bass, but Love played a lot of weird instruments. They played Mosrite guitars, like stuff that I was looking this up. They're not like Fenders. They're not Rickenbackers. And this bass has just sort of this really sort of, it really drives the back end. You know, it's very propulsive. It's very in your face. And you'll hear as we go through this that like Arthur Lee could do like 15 different voices. I mean, he could sing a million different ones. He could be a crooner. He could sing something with a really blues edge. He can sing something folky and soft. And he just had a ton of range. So I think we hear that in that song.
I would ask you, Nick, too, do you think during this classic period, it was Arthur Lee in the studio directing everything and saying, this is what we're going to do. And this is how we're going to arrange it. And we're going to put this on it and that on it. How do you see that?
Everything that I have read about this, for lack of a better term, he was pretty much the dictator.
Yeah.
You know, that's
what I've always understood, too. Yeah.
He had a vision. He knew how I wanted the songs to sound. With the live set, you know, they had banged these songs out like dozens of times, right?
Right.
And they were, and that's pretty well honed.
Classic first album template, right? You get in, play your live set. We saw that. We loved it. Do that. And then we'll go from there.
Yeah. Right, right, right. But yeah, he was certainly the guy in charge. I mean, Brian, and this is very similar to other band stories. You know, Brian McLean was also a songwriter and he wanted to get songs on the Love album. And it was a negotiation with Arthur as to whether that would happen. Brian's songs were, they're a little bit more twee, you know, that were, they're a little more precious. They're not as aggressive as Lee's songs. And, you know, it was kind of hard to squeeze them in. You know, I think Brian wanted five or six songs, but usually got one or two.
Right.
So the Love album is out. These guys are playing the Strip. They are hot. But it's important to sort of remember that it's not like the world suddenly changed because Love was an integrated band that was being successful. I mean, there's a lot of stories of like one story that actually came from, there's a great book called Forever Changes, Arthur Lee and the Book of Love. It's written by John Einerson. Highly recommended. It's kind of the definitive biography. It has a lot of actual quotes from Arthur Lee. Arthur is not always considered the most reliable witness. So what John does a great job of is having quotes from Arthur, but also getting the story from other folks.
Right.
But anyway, I mean, there was one guy recalled who worked at the Whiskey, you know, the Whiskey A Go-Go, another Sunset Strip club, just like kind of being outside and seeing Love had just played a show. And the guy walks outside, you know, an hour later, and there's Johnny Eccles, African-American, and Brian McLean, and they're up against a police van. And basically, it's just because the cops were like, why is this hippie-looking black guy with a white guy? That's a problem. We need to question these guys. They're getting harassed, you know? So there's always that sort of undercurrent. You know, there's the sort of idealism that this is an integrated band that could work together, but it's not like the outside world stopped or that things changed. This was 1967, right? 66. There had been Watts Riot was 1965. It was like the year summer before. Those themes will come out quite a bit in Forever Changes as well. One last thing to mention about this period that is sort of legendary about Love is that they lived in a castle and
actual castle.
Well, they called it the castle. It wasn't an actual castle, but it was a mansion, and it was a mansion that was formerly inhabited by none other than Bela Lugosi, who's someone you might have heard of. And the story is that Brian McLean, his family was sort of well connected with the Hollywood elite. He was also a kid that didn't come from a rough background. That family did quite well.
Totally, yeah.
And he was kind of house-sitting this property just to keep it from squatters. And so they basically said, look, keep an eye on the property. You guys can pay the taxes on it. You can live there. So the band moved into this mansion. And you can look up on YouTube. There's a couple of walkthroughs of this place. It is unbelievable. It's gigantic. And it is everything you would think, sort of an Italianate kind of mansion.
Can I just interject here, Nick? So you watched a walkthrough of the mansion where Love first lived.
Of course.
Okay.
In fact, I watched
a video. Checking the depth of your research, man, because that's pretty
I watched
deep.
One video that was just a dude outside it. So.
Wow.
I've seen the interior.
Research. I mean, I have to take my head off to you. That is beautiful.
It's a huge part of the story, though, because these guys live, the whole band. Can you imagine what it was like? See, these guys are like the biggest band on the LA Strip in 1966. Yeah. All the drugs, all the women, all the alcohol they wanted. And this, although it was a mansion, this was a dilapidated mansion. I mean, this place was actually, although it was gorgeous and it had beautiful arches, there was no furniture. The water wasn't on half the time. You know, the toilets didn't work. You know, there was like mattresses on the floor. So it's very much a part of their legend that they kind of held court in the castle. And it's also one of the reasons why, you know, Arthur famously did not like to tour, did not like to leave L.A., and the castle presented a place where Arthur could just stay and people would come to him. And by people, it was like Janis Joplin, you know, the Grateful Dead, the mother, whoever the hell was in town was staying at the castle at this time. So that was kind of a crazy place. So I did want to play one more song from the debut album, You I'll Be Following, which I think is another great garage rock hit from this album. And just to give you some of the range of Love that you can hear in this, it moves in a slightly different direction from what we heard before. So, so let's take a quick listen to that. Harmonies in that one. And the lyrics aren't especially deep on this album. And I think that's one of the things you'll hear this really great development of Arthur is a poet. You don't hear it so much here, but it's going to happen. So great song, album's out there, tons of expectation. These guys are huge in LA, but the album kind of bombed. You know, it got to 57 on the charts.
Mm-hmm.
They also released a single called My Little Red Book, which was a Burt Bacharach song.
That's right.
Which is another, you know, you all could listen to that and hear how Love took that song from a film, What's New Pussycat, and they gave it the Love spin. That didn't help it either. The record label figured that song had some notoriety. Maybe they get a hit out of it, but they did not.
Covering the Bond theme.
Right.
It's kind of like what that was. Yeah.
Exactly. Cool. So that brings us up to Da Capo, which is their second album. Comes out in November 1966. So again, back in the day, doing an album every 6 months was the thing that these bands did, right?
Yeah,
I find it totally. Just, you know, kind of crazy. But again, not satisfied with it. Arthur needs to move in a new direction. Decides he wants to go kind of like jazz rock, is how I've heard it phrased.
Yeah.
And they bring in some new members. They bring in Michael Stewart, who's a fantastic drummer. And they move Snoopy over to, and I'm not lying, harpsichord and organ. And
you know what? Snoop, you look good with the harpsichord. Let's do that. Yeah.
Snoopy's kind of a sad story because he wasn't a particularly great drummer, but the advantage he had over Don Conca is that he was sober most of the time.
Yeah, well, there's that.
Right. And Arthur liked him. Arthur wanted to keep him in the band. And when they picked up Michael Stewart, they're like, well, you know, he'd played some piano. I was like, we'll move you to harpsichord. And they also brought in this guy, Jay Cantrelli, on saxophone and flute. So now you have seven people in this band, you know, and the sound really evolves. And in fact, I think you hear it right away. If we play the song Stephanie Knows Who, you'll hear this sort of new sound in the first 15 seconds.
What's in your life, dear Stephanie? What's in your life for me? Aches and pains, they cloud your sight. But Tiger did, you said you did. What can I say, dear Stephanie? Who shall I next inform of love and poetry that you bring? Your eyes, your hair, your everything. Yeah! Yeah.
Cool.
Well, and I'll say this, Arthur Lee was constantly chasing his vision. But, you know, one of the most interesting things about this, I think, Nick, you mentioned the harpsichord. It almost, to me, like in this early period, too, and he's about to get to the masterpiece or quote unquote masterpiece, but he heard something, right? He always heard something. He wasn't exactly sure how to approximate it, but he kept chasing it. Would you say that's right?
Totally agree. I think he was never satisfied.
Right.
He never wanted to stay. And, you know, we're talking about a period that
he never scratched the itch.
Right.
Yeah.
And we're talking about a period of like a year and a half, maybe 2 years where these three albums came out. And he's just constantly tinkering with the formula. And but at the same time, again, he would not tour. He wouldn't leave Southern California. Right. And the record company is like, you know, Jack Holzman's like, you guys, I'm a believer. I want you on my label, but go to New York. Right. So he told Arthur, he's like, will you at least come to New York for a few days, 3 days just to see the club scene in New York? Arthur left after like half a day, got back on a plane and came back. And, you know, the thing is, it's like, again, if you wanted to see Arthur, you came to him. He didn't like touring. He didn't like being in hotels. He didn't like the lack of control. But the other aspect to this, which won't be a surprise, is that like as an integrated band in 66, you just don't like tour the South and not have trouble, right?
No.
I mean, he could have done the East Coast, but you know, Johnny Eccles, he's basically said in a quote from the Einarsson book, he's like, being an integrated group made it difficult for us to play in some places. A black group could play the Chitlin circuit in places like that in the South, and a white group could go anywhere in the South, but it was different for an integrated group. And I think this is kind of one of the lesser known aspects. There's a lot of folks who accuse Arthur of just kind of tanking his own career by not playing the game. But there were larger forces at work here. You know, I think it's
totally
partly his personality, but also, you know, again, it's 66. It's touring, you know, down in Georgia with an integrated band. Where are you going to stay? Is there going to be trouble at a venue? You know, the Beatles ran into this kind of trouble when they were touring the
60s. Totally. And I think also, you know, Arthur was not, like you said, he wasn't a street kid. He was an artist, very sensitive. Like he didn't, you know, like to have his artistic art, you know, disturbed. And I praise him for that, too. Yeah, totally having the foresight to protect your art. I mean, that's what it is, right? You have to protect your art.
Exactly, exactly. But, you know, I think Arthur thought that, like, that if you're big in L.A., you could cross over. I mean, they were big in L.A. And, you know, getting back to the Doors were like the little brother band to Love, you know.
Yeah, they kind of were.
And Jim Morrison was in awe of Arthur Lee. In fact, you know, I've seen some interviews with like Ray Manzarek and John Densmore where they're like, we just want to be as big as Love. We're like, if we could be as big as Love and the Sunset Strip, we're happy. Our career is like complete. But, you know, the difference was they toured. They were an all-white band. You know, obviously a challenging lead singer in a lot of ways, but Elektra very quickly focused on them because they were accessible and they would do the hard work and do the press junkets and all that kind of stuff.
Totally.
They very much idolized Love. And in fact, they often opened for Love back in those days. It was a very common thing. One last thing to say about Da Capo to finish this off. There's one more song I wanted to play, but I also want to mention that. So this idea of jazz rock broke down on side two. So side one of the album is six really great pop masterpieces. There's a lot of variability. I would encourage folks, it won't take you a long time. Listen to side one of Da Capo. It's six songs. They're all great. They're all different in their own way. On side two, they decided that they would do a 19-minute long jam. That would just be side two of this album.
That's what people did, though.
Right. And it is, I've avoided it for many, many years. To prepare for this, I put myself through the torture of listening to it like four or five times. And it's just bad. It's just bad. And it's,
you're sick with this, man.
Apparently, they had this song. It's called Revelation. Mm-hmm. And they had this jam that they used to close out their show with, this sort of 15-minute freeform jam. And it sounded great live. But when they got in the studio, it came out crap. And the band was already pretty much hating each other by then, which is another aspect. The vibe was terrible. And it was just a wasted album side, you know, which this band really couldn't afford to do. Because Arthur and Brian had other great songs. And they could have made a great album here. But again, another choice that when kind of Arthur made an artistic choice, right or wrong, whatever the prevailing winds were, he was going to go for it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think Elektra, too, to some extent. So.
Yeah, exactly. They tolerated it,
yeah,
which is great, which is what artists wanted, right? That's, but you kind of wish that someone
that
had
was the deal.
Reined this in a little. Anyway, so one last song from Da Capo is Seven and Seven Is. And that song actually was recorded a little bit before. It was a single. And it's one of the best songs that Love has ever done. It is this just punk, like, it's so ahead of its time. It's something else. And you got to just listen to it. It ends with a, you know, nuclear explosion. which it's a fabulous song, and it has a bit of a different vibe than the other jazz rock stuff. This is pretty straight up.
Totally. Yep.
But when I hear Seven and Seven Is, which again, the reference was Arthur Lee was born March 7th. He was dating a woman also born March 7th. That was, he had a seven thing going. He was kind of into that. But really great single. Unfortunately, it didn't chart. It did like 33, actually. So it actually did better than most of their stuff. I just don't think a lot of audiences were ready for that kind of thing.
No, not at all. Do you know the Ramones later covered that song?
I did not know that.
Yes.
It makes sense, though.
It's on one of their last albums.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah. So there you go. There's the sort of punk connection to that song. Okay. So, Nick, you've talked a lot about the lead up to this great album, and the anticipation is just immense right now. It's just, you know, the pressure, I can't take it anymore. So I want to hear about Love's Forever Changes, but we're going to wait till tomorrow. All right. So this was all the buildup, all the context that you need to know, the foundation. And then listeners come back tomorrow and Nick's going to talk strictly about Forever Changes, right?
That is correct. Right. And I think it's appropriate to end it with a mushroom cloud, right? There's like this nuclear explosion at the end of Seven and Seven Is. Actually, Jack Holzman said at the end of it, he's like, you guys finished with a nuclear explosion. Maybe you should go a little softer stuff. So that's a hint of where we're going with Forever Change.
Sounds good. All right. So come back tomorrow for the second part of this series. It's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us has been
Nick Sclera.
And we'll talk to you, Nick, tomorrow. And we'll talk to all the listeners again tomorrow.
Boom, there it is.